Mr. Feakin, Rail 3, we let you approaching Port Said. Had you realised you were going to the Middle East at that time?
Yes, because we had been issued with pith helmets and KD. But nobody in that particular area would come that much later. All pith helmets, only those going to India. But again, we found out that the ship was destined for India when it left Liverpool, etc. But had changed course because we were needed in the Middle East instead of the Far East. And it was the first time ever I'd seen Arabs and what have you scurrying about like nobody's business. And we got on a train, that's right, from Port Said to a place just outside of Cairo called Almaza, which was the big Royal Artillery garrison. And we really did very little, just marched up and down just to keep us occupied. And I always remember again, just a funny incident. The RSM of the garrison had a little bit of difficulty with his English, with long words. And he came out when the whole garrison was on parade and just said he'd received a message from the Admiralty. And somebody made a crack about his morality wasn't very good. He was on the charge. About the position of the troops at that particular day, and a ship had been sunk. It's rather a shame. Then, from there, that was when I joined the South Knox's Arms.
Now, what that you were sent there? Did anybody else from your draft or your old unit go with you?
One, that
was all. Do you remember his name?
Tommy Beresford. He didn't come into the battery with me.
Now, where were they when you joined them? This is South Knox's Hours 107 Regiment.
That's right.
And where were they?
Gosh.
Were they in Egypt?
I think they were on the borders of Egypt. And is it Libya? Next door. On the borders there.
Do you know when this was? Was this after they'd been in Tobruk? That was...
Yes.
And before Knightsbridge?
Before Knightsbridge.
So you weren't with them that long before Knightsbridge?
No,
just
no.
So if we said sort of March 42, somewhere around that time?
February, March 42, I think it was. It was around there.
And when you joined them, what battery were you put into?
Well, we were... stayed on our own for a while. I think it was Colonel Seeley could sort the wheat from the chaff, which is not an unkind thing to say. And we did various jobs with different batteries.
So this is your draft, and that your draft was about how many?
To be very honest, I think. Because those you didn't know, you didn't know.
So it was just a draft?
Yes, it was just a draft.
And what sort of jobs did they put you on?
I think I did some driving. I did some signalling. And I had done some, I think I'd forgotten, I had done some surveying and that sort of thing with the 94th.
And what under what circumstances were you doing these things? Well, this is just because they were training, basically, as they moved up to Knightsbridge. Or
that's
that.
Right, yes. And they formed 520 Battery. And I was put into 520 Battery.
Which...
I didn't know then that it was the creme a la creme.
Now, which troop were you in?
Actually, I wasn't in a troop at all. I became the battery commander's driver and ACK, which we called is the battery commander's assistant at the OP.
Now, that was Gary Birkin.
Gary Birkin.
P.G. Birkin.
That's right.
Major P.G. Birkin. Now,
wonderful man.
That's what I was going to ask you. Could you tell me a little about your first impressions of Gary Birkin?
When I very first met him, which of course is when I reported to him, and he said, you're Bobby Afikins, and I said, yes, sir. He said, I've asked for you. I thought, well, that's very strange, because I'd never met him. And I found him to be very quiet, unassuming, and a very sincere man. Not as one would visualise a battery commander.
In what way? Well, I mean, how would you visualise a battery commander and how did he differ?
Well, I've been used to a battery commander not swearing or anything like that, but very outgoing, very precise in his words and clipped. Gary Birkin was very quiet. I thought a very charming man. And as I got to know him more, I was more impressed than I was at the beginning.
We'll probably come across that. You were his driver. What vehicle were you to drive?
A Marlon Harrington armoured car.
And what was that like to drive?
Pig.
In what way?
Well, it was solid steel, of course, being an armoured car. It was made in South Africa. I think I'm right if I say it was a Ford V8 engine, which was a pig to get at. And with that weight behind it, it wasn't the easiest vehicles to manoeuvre, because your vision wasn't all that good. But
so
got on with it all right.
You'd sit in the driver's seat, front right.
That's right.
What other seats and people would be in it? On the left, next to you?
Next to me would be Gary Birkin. Directly behind me was a wireless operator. And behind Gary, there would be two wireless operators. One, of course, was into battery regiment. The other was into brigade. And one direct back to our own battery. Which was one regiment, one battery, and one brigade.
And that was your whole crew?
That was the whole crew, five of us.
Do you remember their names?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. Don't ask me why I remember it, but he used to work at Moss Cross in London. But I can't remember his name.
I mean, in the book, it's in the big incident that's to come, two names that are mentioned are Gunner J.H. Wright. Do you remember him at all?
Yes, I think he was a radio operator. Now that you mention the name, it comes back to me.
And the other one it mentions are Murray. Presumably, signaller Gunner Murray.
Well, he must be the signaller that was on the same side as Wright. Yes, because there was another one.
There's Lloyd and White, it I see now, because they were the ones that were killed. But let's leave the names for now, because there's no point pushing your memory further than it'll go. So you were joining 520 Battery. Some of the other headquarters staff, I wonder whether you remembered the battery captain was Bennett, Charles Bennett, and there was Boney Bonello,
Commander. I know very well. If you remember, I chatted with you. Bernie, I remember, because he was, I think he was in the Middlesex Regiment or whatever. He was signals anyway. And he travelled with us quite often. And he and I got on very well. I think he was a captain at the time, I'm not sure.
And what about Bennett?
Bennett, I can't remember.
And the signal sergeant was Sergeant S. Giles. Would you recall him?
Only remember him as a signal sergeant. I very seldom came in contact with any of the other battery. Very strange. Gary kept us well away from them. We billeted on our own. And in the desert, we were a single unit. And always, of course, when we were in the desert, we were right up in front. We were the OP, the eyes of the whole battery. Mouths in front of everybody.
So you joined the unit, and they were somewhere on the border area, uh-huh. And this is the time they were getting ready to go up in the desert. How did you settle in then, or not much settling in to do if you were kept apart?
No, there wasn't a great deal of settling in because we remained virtually on our own, detached from the battery as such. Used to meet occasionally, but not long enough to get to know any of the other people.
Now, what about your food and your rations, water? Food, how was that dealt with as a slightly separate, detached unit, part of the unit?
Yes, I'm trying to think who did what on our thing. Of course, me being the driver and ACK. One of the signalers, or radio operators, I should say, not signalers, did the cooking. It wasn't bad. He had some very good ideas.
What sort of food did you get? Do you remember?
Bully beef, hard biscuits. We didn't eat the hard biscuits as biscuits. But the chappie that did the cooking used to mix water with it. And I think we called it burgoo. I can't.
What was the bully like?
Oh, it wasn't bad. Sometimes he'd mix it in with the burgoo and call it a stew. No, it never worried me. As long as it was enough to go around, it didn't worry me. Sure, water was always a shortage. And I remember, because we used to buzz off a long way away from the battery, obviously looking for areas for the battery to move into to the best advantage, having been given that order by regiment to move. And I remember we came across a well and we thought, marvellous. Till we looked in and found out so many dead at the bottom of the well, it wasn't true. Happy to say they weren't Brits. So, Italians and Germans.
So, as you moved up, they were training in a new mobile role, because they had been very static in Tobruk and,
yes,
and Mercer, and they'd never really... do you remember anything about this training period and also this business about them being used slightly as decoys? It's a strange system that they had. You might not even have been aware of what was happening in that line. But do you remember the training at all?
Yes, training was very hard. We had to make very quick moves. Decisions came through. We had to move very quickly. And I remember what appeared to me to be very strange. Digging quads in. You dug a slope into the sand so that you weren't that much higher than the level of the ground. And I know I got into a bad patch and I drove in. I had to get the armoured car back out again. But, I do remember, I be in the middle of working out angle of sight and distances with Gary, and we'd be off somewhere else, and then the whole thing start all over again. Line the guns up for this, nothing happened. Like possibly that's what you were talking about, but nobody told us what it was all about.
So your job was, not only did you have to drive,
not the reason why.
You not only drove, but when you got there, you would act as the OPAC.
Yes, I was the OPAC.
And what were your duties as OPAC?
Which I thought was rather strange, because most, Ivor and all the others, had an OPAC and a driver. Now, because I had done OPAC and GPAC before with my old regiment, and of course the OC had my papers, he knew what I had done. It wasn't a case of could you do this, could you do that. I see you've done this, you will. End of story. And he said, you're going back a little bit when it started. He said, you're a driver, and I said, yes. He said, you're an ACK. I said, yes, sir. He said, right, you're now my ACK driver, OPAC driver. I didn't hesitate to say, most unusual thing, because that's two men. But I think he was thinking about the number of people in the quad.
The armoured car.
Sorry, the armoured car, yes. Going back to being a gunner.
So, what were your duties? What were the duties of an OPAC? Because we haven't covered that yet. If you just could sketch in what you had to do.
Well, lines of sight. We had maps. We had to do pinpointing. We had to, of course, get to the positions. When we were there, distances, angle of sight. I didn't do a great deal more than that. Gary occasionally would sit down in the vehicle and I would do the signalling and what have you. And we used to steer with some Gary generally upstairs with a left foot on my shoulder and a right foot on my right shoulder. We had a sundial on the roof of the armoured car. And we used to steer through the desert by the sundial. And
so, when he wasn't sat next to you, he would be in the turret. Is it a turret or...?
Yes, open turret. Not a turret like a tank. You could close it, but it was just flat. And at times he would drive, and I would sit up there. And we worked, I think we worked marvellously together. I mean, if he suddenly saw something he wasn't happy with, he'd turn and say, stop, bomber, come up here. And I would go up, take sightings and what have you, and say, yes, sir, or no, sir, I don't think so, or whatever. We did that part together.
And who would actually do the sending of the corrections to the guns?
Gary would give the corrections to the radio operators back to the gun positions.
So that they'd actually send it, the thing. Did you learn the sort of sequence of fire orders, you know, the...
Oh, gosh, yes.
I don't know whether you remember it. It's a lot to remember, actually.
No, I'm sorry. That I can't remember. Standard, of course, number one gun fire, or if it was really hot and sticky, number one gun fire in your own time. Actual orders of the gun position, I'm not very sure about. So I did very little back there.
So during this training, you'd be essentially going off to the new positions.
That's right.
And then going on further to act as OP positions. So you'd check out the next move of the battery, and then from there you'd go on to form the OP, looking for the enemy or whatever you were meant to be.
Yes, and I can remember passing the enemy going in different directions. And the guy would say, wave to them, wave to them. And he'd take off his things so they couldn't be seen, because we wore virtually the same kit, KD.
Now, when was that? Because you were, Fire 20 was in action for almost only one day, because it was roughly
one. This was before the action took place.
While you were moving up into the desert.
Whilst we were moving about.
What do you remember of that? Can you tell me that incident in more detail?
They were in a three-tonner. I was in the armoured car. I'm looking out there to try and get a distance. 150, 200 yards, maybe a little more. We were going as we were, away from our own guns towards the enemy lines. And obviously he was lost, because he was going towards our enemy lines. And we just called out, waved, and they waved back. They disappeared into the blue, for which we were very happy, because they had guns and we didn't. That was the end of them. But I do remember I sat on the... the regimental things. Sometimes I was sitting as a radio operator to give them a break. I suppose I was jack of all trades.
It sounds a real team effort.
Oh, it was very much a team effort. Very much. I felt very much at home with these people. And I always remember one morning I did get... I would break the rules occasionally. And I would listen in to the German issuing orders. Sometimes I'd be, Morgen wie geht's Ihnen? Danke Sie, liebe Krieg ist gut, nicht wahr? And he'd come back and say, was sagen Sie? Bist du British? I'd say, ja. Wo haben Sie Deutsch gelernt? Said in Deutschland as a kinder, in Schule. And this happened two or three times. One day, he very surprised me, he spoke in his English is almost as good as any Brit. And I sent a message back to our own battery, and he came on, he said, Bobby, that is not the correct procedure. That's something that always stick in my mind. And he'd been at Oxford. His name was Carl. But I'm more than that, of course, I never know.
So you were moving up, through April, May time. Mm. Any other incidents you remember?
Oh, yes. One particular one, when we were going right forward, we were on our own, completely on our own, lying behind an escarpment. And Gary had asked me prior to this to find something very small that we could to make our fire in, because we used to make them in 4-gallon drum, petrol, empty drums with sand and petrol, which is a very volatile combination. And I found this very large empty shell case being fired, and just took so much sand, enough to boil a kettle on. So we'd sat behind with the armoured car facing our own troops, obviously, so that we could make a quick getaway. And lying behind the escarpment, Gary and I were sitting on what was the toolbox at the back, which is a flat piece at the back of the armoured car. And all of a sudden the kettle, the sand, the whole lot went up through the camouflage net. Well, we didn't know it wasn't an unexploded shell case. It was a shell case that had been taken away from its other end, and the detonator was still in the bottom of the shell case. But we had a camouflage net over us, and we broke cover immediately, headed back for our rear lines, with the camouflage net burning like hell all around us. I don't think that armoured car moves so fast in its life, because we were only lying just under the escarpment. When we moved to the escarpment, we could actually see the German troops over the hill. And the smoke going up from our camouflage netting was a dead giveaway. But we got back all right.
During this period, you seem to have been in contact with the Germans, but you weren't actually in action.
Oh, no, not in action. We had visual contact with them two or three times, but nothing took place.
Just covering a couple of points, do you remember the Duke of Gloucester's visit?
Oh, yes, very much.
Tell me about that.
He came up. We dug a special trench for him as a toilet, just in case either he wanted to go to the loo or Jerry opened up on us. It was a slit trench ready for him to dive into. And he got in at the back. I think I was sat at a radio set. Gary got up through to the turret, stood on the turret. The Duke of Gloucester went up through. I don't know, you might have heard this from somebody else. The Duke of Gloucester broke wind, and it was pulling himself up through the turret. And as I said, he broke wind quite badly, and one of the operators, he had his phone on, of course, not hearing too much what was going on, turned around and said, "Jesus Christ, who the bloody hell is shit?" And the Duke must have heard it. I gave him a great smack across the head, and he suddenly realized what he'd said and to whom he had referred. That was the end of that story, but I would have thought you would have heard that from someone.
The Duke didn't react then?
No.
Was he disciplined, the wireless operator, or just the smack on the head?
No, I gave him a smack across the head. I can't remember whether even Gary referred to it afterwards. I can't remember.
But they must have heard.
Well, they heard what he said. But, I mean, it could have been anybody downstairs that had done it. I think Gary did say something, but I can't remember what it was that he said. But it's something, another funny that sticks in my memory. And, of course, I couldn't hear what they were talking about because I was inside the armored car. But they did recall, if my memory serves me right, seeing a lot of Bedouins going across the firing line, which Gary was very angry about because we were in a firing position. And these Bedouins were moving right across the firing line. The Duke eventually came down, got into his vehicle, and away he went. Gary was very pleased with the visit and the fact that the Prince had come to our vehicle and to 520. I think that was the end of that episode.